Okay, I'd intended to have room to draw a little map, but didn't have one. So we were talking last time. We're in the church period of Smyrna. It runs from 200 A.D. to 325 A.D. And we were covering last time all of the ways, you know, that things went downhill doctrinally and every other way. And so we were talking about that. I need to shift over and talk to you a little bit more. If you'll remember a guy named Origen, because his life started in Ephesus and he went on through part of Smyrna, we kind of covered him back then, but this is the time he's living in now in Smyrna. And you'll recall, if you listened, that he got booted out of Alexandria, Egypt. He's a tremendous, although ingenious, corrupter of the Bible and doctrine. And when he left Alexandria, Egypt, he moved up the coast of Israel to a place called Caesarea. And if you want to know where Caesarea is, if you know where Tel Aviv is, and if you know where Mount Carmel is, Caesarea is pretty much kind of right in between, right on the coast. We were just there in Israel. That's where Herod was eaten of worms and all that stuff. We saw the town. Let me take you real quick to Acts 23 real fast to show you something else that happened there. It's just not much good happened at Caesarea, and either in the Bible or in history. Acts 23 and down in verse 33, this is the place where they brought Paul to be tried. Verse 33, who, when they came to Caesarea, delivered the epistle to the governor, presented Paul also before him. So that's where Paul went through some of his trial before they finally sent him off to Rome. And there's some things that happened in Caesarea because Origen moved up there, started a new school that was just as bad as the old one. And there are just some guys I want to point out to you real fast. These are all bad guys. Had some of these on the board last time and didn't get to them. So we're starting up here with Pamphilus. Pamphilus was one of Origen's disciples. He continued the school after Origen died. There he established a large library, co-authored a book called In Defense of Origen. And Origen is indefendable, by the way. But literally, he was just another total apostate, philosophy-infested heretic. Next guy, though, is somebody you might hear about a little bit if you read any at all from back there. His name was Eusebius. He was trained in Caesarea under Pamphilus. He is known as the father of church history. He wrote one of the first church histories, although it was largely infested with the wrong stuff, wrong doctrine and stuff. But he was the bishop of Caesarea, and he also wrote a book called The Life of Constantine. Now, you'll talk about Constantine later, but Eusebius was really just a bootlicking politician, and he just fawned over Constantine the Great, the last name you see on the board there. We'll talk about him in a sec. He was part of Constantine's team that handled things at the Council of Nicaea, which actually ends the time period of Smyrna. But his lasting legacy was that Constantine, when he became the emperor, wanted 50 copies of the Bible in vellum. So that's leather. And Constantine made him 50 Bibles, and there are still two of them that exist today. They are known as Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. Okay? Those we believe, or historians believe, are actually two copies of Bibles that Eusebius was responsible for. And those are the two things that all liberal commie-lib theologians run to. Vaticanus and Sinaiticus. Vaticanus was found, you might guess it, in the Vatican. And we'll go maybe through some of it later, not today, not this at this time, but Vaticanus was literally found in a trash bin in the Vatican. Sinaiticus was found in a at the monastery on Mount Sinai, and it is they're both corrupt. They conflict with one another. They show signs of being corrected and rewritten over and all this kind of stuff. Those are two totally abominable manuscripts. And so all of basically you'll find on the in the main that two of the manuscripts that New Bibles always cite when New Bible scholars change the Bible is Sinaiticus and Vaticanus. So they're completely corrupt, and they were from Caesarea technically, but they're Alexandrian manuscripts. Anyway, Eusebius opposed premillennialism, so he did not believe. Most of the church fathers, even though all of them were not perfect, believed in the premillennial return of Christ. If you don't believe in the premillennial return, then probably what you believe is that things just keep getting better and better until one day Jesus has to come back. And that, of course, is the Catholic Church position. That is many church historians' positions, and that it's totally wrong. Nothing gets fixed until Jesus Christ comes back. Amen. So Eusebius did not take the Bible literally. He wrote this about the light in the life of Constantine, and again, we'll cover Constantine in just a little while. Constantine's conquering of the empire, so when Constantine became the emperor, was the fulfillment of a Christian kingdom which would finally convert the world to Christianity. Really, out of that sprig sprung the Roman Catholic Church. And that's the exact idea. He also said this. He said that he considered Constantine's liberation of Christianity, and we'll talk more about it later, equal to Moses in Egypt. So what Constantine accomplished in the Roman Empire was equal to what Moses accomplished in Egypt. Yes, sir?
Liberating Christianity?
I don't know. He didn't either. And then there's a guy with a weird name, Gregory somebody. And he was known as a wonder worker. He said he received a declaration of faith in a night vision from St. John at the request of the Virgin Mary. And of course it all bolstered what we now know as Roman Catholic doctrine. But basically it was just a nut job. Anyway, so the school in Alexandria is basically done after Origen's departure a few years later. It kind of closed down in the 400s, and Caesarea then continued on, carrying on Origen's legacy. Now, there's some other personages in Smyrna that I want you to know about. First of all, there's Cyprian. Now, you've heard from him. He is a raunchy heretic. He was the pastor down in Carthage, North Africa. So if you went around the corner along the African coast and ran east, pretty much midway across the continent, then you get over to Carthage, North Africa. It's right off, it's across the Med from the boot of Sicily. So it's further over than Alexandria. But Cyprian was trained in rhetoric, whatever that means. Rhetoric is philosophy, and I guess arguing about philosophy, but he was trained in rhetoric. Supposedly converted in 245 AD, became the bishop of Carthage. He was influenced by a good guy, Tertullian, who's a good guy, a Montanist, but he still went south. He wrote something like 81 epistles, so letters to churches and stuff. He was supposedly a devoted pastor, had great love and devotion for his flock, but he was also one of the most influentially destructive men in the New Testament church history. He was the first church father clearly in favor of baptizing infants. If you'll remember, I told you that story last week about Fidus, the guy who's pastoring in North Africa. He's worried because the pagans are sacrificing their babies before they can be baptized. And so he wanted to go baptize the babies so he could save them. Because when you baptize a baby, it saves them. And so he went to Cyprian, who called the Council of Carthage of 252 and got the pastors together, and they decided that you could baptize a baby after 8 days and thus save it in case its parents wanted to sacrifice it to pagan gods, but it could still go to heaven then. So this is the guy. He was the first that we know of to ever apply Matthew 16 to Rome. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I'll build my church, the Roman Catholic Church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it, the Roman Catholic Church. It's how Catholics, and frankly, and a lot of Christians exposit that verse, and that's not how the verse is exposited. Thou art Peter, and upon this rock, Christ pointing to himself, I'll build my church. The gates of hell shall not prevail against the rock. Because Jesus is the only one that went to hell, and the gates of hell could not prevail against it. Amen. It's not saying the gates of hell could not prevail against the church. The church never went to hell. As far as I know, the church is not trying to go to hell. So it doesn't even make any sense if you just stop and think about it. But he's the first one. If you corner a Catholic, the Catholic's going to say Matthew 16 applies to the Catholic Church. And he's the first one to apply it that way. In short, he fast-forwarded the development of Roman heresy, Nicolaitanism, the baptismal heresy, the communion heresies, and infant baptism. He was the one that pretty much turned, or helped to turn, North Africa into a hotbed of apostasy for years and years to come. And that's him. Now, the next guy along the way is actually a good guy. I don't have too many good guys in this at this juncture for you. We'll see some good groups coming up here later, not tonight. But the next guy was a guy named Hippolytus. He was a bishop up near Rome in a place called Pontus. He was elected bishop, though, without episcopal consecration. So apparently the church just decided they liked him and hired him as pastor, which is how it's supposed to be, right? Instead of through the episcopal methods of hierarchy and all that kind of stuff. So he was a thorn in the side of the false prophets in Rome. He gave the Roman church, by this time that was completely defunct, filled with a bunch of hireling apostates, he gave them a fit. He boldly opposed the bishops of Rome, their pretensions, their sensual wickedness. And in fact, he refused to have all communion with them when they would call him to want to have coffee or come have a meeting. He refused to even fellowship with them, which is good. So I like him. One of the pastors that was in Rome when this guy pastored nearby was named Calixtus. He was literally a slave, a thief, and a con man who wormed his way into being the pastor of the Church of Rome, and Hippolytus exposed him. So again, you have to like Hippolytus. He condemns all errors opposed to the Scriptures. This is what was said about him. Hippolytus condemned all errors, opposed to the Scriptures, and binds every article of his faith to the Scriptures' teachings. So, again, a good guy who checked the Bible before he would believe something. So that's a good thing. He eventually was exiled and supposedly drowned in the Tiber River by the emperor. So he died a martyr. Okay, so the next major guy we want to talk about is Constantine the Great. But let me catch up with something that's going on. Starting in Ephesus, there were 10 official Roman persecutions. All right, so we covered five of them, talked a little bit about five of them. that happened back during Ephesus. So the last five of them take place during Smyrna. And I need to just fill in blanks for you, because this is going to affect what Constantine was able to do later. The fifth imperial Roman persecution was by a guy named Septimus Severus. You see there with the fifth. He was the last emperor covered in Ephesus, but he was the fifth imperial Roman persecution. A guy followed him named Caracalla, who basically continued the persecutions, but was generally disinterested in religion and just kind of coasted along. The next guy was a guy, and he's not on the board, named Heliogabulus. Roman names, wow. Anyway, he's a really vile, lustful dude, worshiped Satan, the sun god, but tolerated all religions. So what you're going to see here in these next just a couple pages of notes is that you would have a guy rise up and persecute, destroy the Christians, and then there would be sometimes years where the next emperor, and the next emperors, in fact, would be very tolerant of Christians, and so the Christians would kind of flow back and get back kind of in, you know, in the scheme of things in society and stuff, and they were basically, you know, yo-yoed back and forth between being raunchily persecuted versus being pretty much accepted and old school now. So this is a real bad rubber band effect. Heliogabulus was a very vile, lustful man. The next guy along the way was a guy named Alexander Severus. And he extended tolerance to Christians broadly. It may be because his mother was a Christian. Some people believe that. But he even went so far as to place busts of Christ and Abraham in his private chapel, which for a Roman emperor was, you know, usually not very common that that happened. But he was the first emperor to entertain pastors in his court. He built some Christian churches, started to legalize Christianity, but his soothsayers said that that would be that would be bad luck. So he decided not to. And what you're getting the idea of here is the Romans were very superstitious pagan people. So no matter how much people try to lift up the Roman Empire these days, don't buy it. They're a bunch of pagan superstitious fools. So Christianity enjoys this brief respectability under Severus. There were some pastors that accepted appointments to civil offices. So they were hired by the government. The church was thus overall weakened by a lapse in, you know, kind of a false security. And so with that comes a guy named Maximinus down at the bottom, the sixth official imperial persecution. Maximinus assassinated the last emperor that we were talking about, and in resentment to him, burned the churches and refueled the persecutions. Earthquakes, floods, droughts, and plagues were blamed on Christians. There were thousands slain without trials. There were mass graves everywhere. People lying dead all over the place. Several thousand were burned at one time alive in their place of worship in one town. Just set the church on fire and burn it down around them. So, you know, this guy was a bad dude, Maximinus. The next guy that followed him was Gordian the Third. He didn't persecute anybody. He was followed by a guy named Philip, who for about 5 years reigned. He actually favored Christianity and left the churches alone. He was denounced publicly as a Christian, and he may have been a Christian. It may be that that's why he didn't persecute them. We're not sure. But because of the extended peace, the Christians again joined hands with the Romans. And so, you know, there were hopes at this point that Christianity would replace paganism as a system. And, you know, you're getting the idea here of, you know, how it goes with elections. The Democrats get in, then the Republicans get in, and while the Republicans are in, it's like, yeah, we're going to get it anyway. We're going to turn things around. And it never happens that way. It just keeps going back and forth, like a tennis match. Okay, you ought to learn something from that. Because that's what happened here. It's never settled. And as long as you're in this world, it's not going to be settled until Jesus Christ comes back. Anyway, because of the extended peace, the Christians once again kind of joined hands with the Romans and started living the good life and had more wealth and had good jobs, etc., etc. Then along comes a guy named Decius Trajan up there on top, the seventh official Roman persecution. He was determined to restore the unity and vigor of Rome, which included the revival of the state religion concept. So he sought full legal suppression of all Christianity. In 250 AD, that's where we're at with this, he issued edicts requiring Christians to appear before a magistrate, renounce their faith, and offer sacrifice to a legal Roman god. So you are summoned to come before effectively the sheriff or administrator or whatever, and there you have to renounce your faith and offer sacrifice to a legal Roman god. Multitudes of nominal Christians, whether they were really saved or not, who knows, recanted, and they were much encouraged, by the way, by seeing what is described here. And you can read a ton of this kind of stuff in Martyrs' Mirrors or Fox's Book of Martyrs, but this gives you a little bit of a taste of what all was going on. Okay, this is Trajan. He aimed at the full legal suppression of Christianity, and the government put forth its whole strength accordingly. The terror of his persecutions had scarcely been equaled before. One historian named Limbork fully endorses the alarming picture in his history of persecutions when he says of those who would not blaspheme Christ and offer incense to the gods that they were publicly whipped, drawn by the heels through the city's streets of the city, racked until every bone of their body was disjointed, had their teeth knocked out, their noses, hands, and ears cut off, sharp-pointed spears run under their nails, tortured with melted lead thrown on their naked bodies, had their eyes digged out, their limbs cut off, were condemned to the mines, ground between stones, stoned to death, burned alive, thrown headlong from high buildings, beheaded, smothered in burning lime kilns, run through the body with sharp spears, destroyed with hunger, thirst, and cold, thrown to the wild beast, broiled on gridirons with slow fires, cast by heaps into the sea, crucified, scraped to death with sharp seashells, torn to pieces by the boughs of trees, and in a word, destroyed by all the various methods that the most diabolical subtlety and malice could devise. So, if you want just an ongoing narrative of that, there's a book called Martyrs' Mirrors. You can still get it. It's actually a Moravian writing. So again, Moravians were good guys in church history. But it's a full dictionary-sized book. It's this thick, the size of a dictionary. And it's all just filled with the history of martyrs and how they died. It's just, it'll keep you up at night. But the Christians were subject to all forms of confiscation, exile, division of families, torture, bribery, and all those things. Many stayed true, but there were those that turned their copies of the scriptures that they had on their persons in to be burned. Those were called traitores. So you can see in there traitors, but they were called traitores because they gave their Bibles up to be burnt. And what you ought to stop and think about sometime is, when you think about this stuff, is what would it take for you to give up your Bible? Yeah. Now, if you're hearing your daughter scream, being tortured, or your son scream, or your wife scream, what would it take for you to give up the Bible and say, sure, take it and burn it. I'll never pick it up again. Those who didn't give the scriptures up but recanted of their faith were called the lapsi. So lapsed, lapsi. Many pastors and deacons fled to exile. Sometimes they went because they were scared and were dishonorable in that respect, but sometimes they had actually the hopes of leaving so that maybe the officials would leave their flocks alone. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. So Trajan was followed by a guy named Gallus, who basically continued the persecutions, and then was followed by a guy named Valerian. Now, Valerian was the eighth official Roman persecutor, or the one that authored it. He passed an edict requiring all Christians to conform to the Roman state or to be banished. He prohibited Christian assembly for any reason at any time. And of course, there were some that went anyway, but many didn't. All bishops and deacons were to be automatically put to death. Any Christian or convert was to have his property automatically seized. At first, he was a mild ruler, but then he began persecuting Christians. And again, he's the eighth official imperial Roman persecutor. He's the one that actually killed a Cyprian, who was a heretic, and okay, he died. So what? The next guy along the way was a guy named Gallienus, who proclaimed edicts of toleration and recalled the exiles. So again, you go from one guy who is just obsessed with killing, torturing Christians. And then you have a next guy that comes in that doesn't want to and welcomes them back, offers them to bring them back from wherever they've been exiled and such. He made Christianity actually an acknowledged religion in 261. Under Claudius, the next guy, the peace continued. And then there came a guy named Aurelian. You see him there above Diocletian. He hated Christians and reissued the edicts against them. He is called the Restorer of the Empire. And again, the ninth imperial Roman persecutor. At the time that he was supposed to sign the edict of persecution, he literally reached out on his desk, took the pen in hand to write the edict, and he was smitten with paralysis. Just as he reached for the pen, he couldn't move his hand anymore. He became obsessed from that point with the extermination of Christians and was terrified anytime it thundered or lightninged. So I think he had a bad conscience, maybe. His persecutions were shortened by his assassination. After him, there were six obscure emperors over the next 9 years. They kind of left the church untouched. The devil used that 9 or 10 years to gradually accelerate the apostasy and worldliness of Christianity. Multitudes of nominal Christians adopted the idea of whatever Caesar likes, I like. You know, whatever Caesar says, I'll do, because they just wanted to get along. So the wealth of the churches increased. Extravagant churches were built. The ordinances became more, you know, sacramental and formal. And church discipline lacked and all that kind of stuff. Then along came a guy named Diocletian. He is the 10th and last imperial Roman persecutor. He's the worst of them all. He is the last of the so-called pagan Roman emperors, because after him came Constantine. And we'll have to talk about him later. But in 303 AD, Diocletian began a series of 5 cruel edicts that, you know, his co-regents, his sub-rulers were a part of. Christian buildings were pulled down. Bibles, tracts, and literature was all burned. The civil rights of all Christians was forfeited. Pastors especially were spotlighted for persecution. And Diocletian called himself the Lord and Master of the world. He also is known as the Vicar of Jupiter. Galerius was one of his co-regents, also happened to be a son-in-law, and he issued another edict in his province, which said that Christians couldn't buy or sell without first offering sacrifice to Roman gods. So that's a forerunner of the mark of the beast. You know, so there's nothing new about what Satan inspires. One day he's going to get his guy and he's going to run the world. But that's happened over and over again, where you know you can't buy or sell unless you offer to a Roman god or some such like thing like that. Christian children were habitually slain without any kind of, you know, just find one in the street, drag it out of its mother's bosom and kill it. Diocletian burned an entire city in Phrygia up in Asia Minor, which was a holy Christian city. And so, I forgot what this quote was. Just give me a second. One guy is given, during his reign, a guy named John was a blind Egyptian, and he memorized the entirety of the New Testament with perfection. He could repeat the whole thing. And his eyes, even though he was blind already, they put his eyes out with hot irons and killed him. Diocletian's persecutions lasted 10 years, and it was severer than all that had gone before. It acted like a fire on incense, and drawing one of the finest and richest essences in Christian character. One day, when it was beginning to abate, the emperor's bedchamber was found in flames. Diocletian was stricken with terror and suspecting his Christian servants. Suspecting his Christian servants, he put them to torture, stood by to pull their confessions from them. 2 weeks later, a second fire occurred in the same room. He was more enraged than ever, made closer inquisition for blood in the palace. Several servants were put to death. The empress was put to death, and Diocletian's own daughter, who was a Christian, was compelled to sacrifice to other gods. No language can describe the brutality of this persecution under Diocletian. It is estimated that 17,000 suffered death in 1 month. 144,000 were martyred in Egypt alone. And of the banished and those condemned to the public works, no less than 700,000 died. In some provinces, scarcely a Christian was left. So great was the triumph against Christianity that it was commemorated by striking off a gold coin. On one side was the head of Diocletian crowned with a laurel, and on the reverse, a Jupiter brandishing a thunderbolt and trampling under the Christians. So that was the setting for what's going on. And the next guy that comes up is going to be a guy named Constantine. We can't open up with him tonight, but... just so you understand, the effect of this was the Christians were yo-yoed between persecution and comfort, so on and so forth. So hard. The martyrs who did die were thought of as almost deified because they stood for their faith. And those that survived persecution, the devil still got his licks in. Because these were often called confessors, and folks would go to them because they were esteemed to hold more sway with God than the average Christian. They started venerating anybody that died for Christ, whether they were a true Christian or not. And they started venerating relics, you know, pieces of their hair, pieces of their clothing, that sort of thing. So the Catholic Church later on in history went completely crazy with that stuff. You know, Mary's milk and all this kind of stuff, and it's just crazy. But that's where the relic stuff started. We're just reminded that things went really far south there. And so Christianity is now tired. bloody, wounded. It is now partially superstitious. It's intermingled with unbiblical ideals. It's not that many that are really true Bible believers. The rest of Christianity that's tired is ready to sell out to the right guy that'll show up. So a guy shows up and says, let's just make Christianity the religion of the empire. That was Constantine. And you'll see that he wasn't very, that wasn't a very sincere offer. But we have to wait now. By the way, Constantine's name is actually Flavius Valerius Aurelius Constantinus. Anyway, we'll have to talk about him next time. Questions or comments?